might say, good afternoon, Lagos. How are you? Lagos, Nigeria, wherever you're listening to us from, those of you who listen from the abroad, I have been told to tell you sorry. You know, I can't pick up your Skype calls because my guests usually join via Zoom, but you can send us a WhatsApp message. Right. How are you? Have you been keeping up with what's been going on? You know what we do on Borderlines? We go beyond the borders. We talk about things that affect our world, which actions that have been done by those who shape our world. And of course, the biggest, biggest news that has been shaping and reshaping our world is Israel's genocidal war on Gaza or Palestine, whichever you like to call it. Right. Today, I have with me, I know you guys think I always say this, but this is the honest truth. We get some of the best guests, international. Not only do they come with knowledge, not only are they informed, not only do they have exceptional experience, but Mary Nazal Batanyaye, and she's going to correct me how I pronounce that, is simply one that you must Google. You know, if I'd been on Down for Conversations, I would already have said to you people, go and Google my next guest so you can be ready. But really, when I say you need to Google Mary, you need to Google Mary. It is my absolute pleasure to have barrister, justice activist, and it's interesting she calls herself that, justice activist, impact entrepreneur, and also, according to Forbes, one of the most important Arab female voices with us on Borderlines today. She's a human rights activist and she's going to be unpacking the whole ICJ hearing for us. Mary, welcome to Borderlines.
Thank you so much for having me.
It is a pleasure. The other thing I didn't tell you all about Mary is that she's the founder of the Palestinian Legal Fund. I'm going to talk about that because that's going to take us to where we want to go next. Mary, you started the Palestinian Legal Fund some 15 years ago, okay? At the time when you started, it was pretty nouveau, let's be frank, you know, and it was inspired by the same fund that was used, you know, to keep Nelson Mandela out of jail. Tell us about PLAF, what you did with PLAF, and why PLAF was important at the time and where we are today with it.
Of course. Thank you for the question. So, Ereti, you're referring to a fund that we started after Operation Cast Lead. And the purpose of the fund at that time was to fund and facilitate human rights cases on behalf of the Palestinians. And I think that it's really important that we draw attention to the fact that we were doing this over 15 years ago, because some people that have just been introduced to the plight of the Palestinian people think that this is something new. But in fact, the Palestinian people have been going through continuous acts of dispossession, injustice, colonialism, apartheid, and so on since 1948. And there have been numerous attempts to bring Israel to justice, because as you can see and we've witnessed over the almost 100 days, Israel believes it's above the law and it can do that, obviously, because it's aided and abetted by the world's foremost power. So what we did 15 years ago is try and hold Israel to account. And we did that through war crimes cases. We also did it through third state responsibility and corporate cases. And I mention that because we have to know that the Israeli colonial apartheid state can't be doing what it's doing if it wasn't for the support of Western powers, both government and corporates. So when we look at the legal strategy vis-a-vis the Palestinian people from now on, we do look at the ICC and the ICJ, which we'll talk about in more detail, but we should also look at third states who are aiding and abetting these practices through their political positions, through the arms trade. We have to look at corporations that are aiding and abetting Israel, like Meta, through discrimination and subjugation of Palestinian voices. So the legal strategy is actually multi-pronged. And as someone who's been doing this for, over 25 years, I am so excited to see the number of new voices that has joined our calls for justice like we see today.
Thank you. You Let me read out a quote of yours to you, which will lead us into what's going on right now. You said, "We are fed up of empty statements given by world leaders who claim that Israel is acting illegally, but end up doing nothing about it. And because Israel will only change if we force it to." Yesterday, we saw the South Africans present their case. What are your thoughts on that? And then we'll talk about Israel's case this morning.
I mean, I think my thoughts reflect the feelings of many, in the sense that we saw yesterday as one of the most momentous moments in history for the Palestinian people. What we saw is a courageous state like South Africa that we have a lot of shared experiences with, being brave and taking Israel and the United States to the highest court on the planet. And I can tell you, in Jordan, we had people outside the South African embassy literally in tears, out of gratitude for what South Africa has done. And the fact that it's South Africa that has gone through this apartheid experience, and a state in a continent that has also gone through their post-colonial moment, for them to give us our moment in court was absolutely phenomenal. So that's sort of on the emotional side. But on the legal side, South Africa put together a stellar team of lawyers from South Africa and beyond. And their statements, including the 84-page document that preceded yesterday, is one of the most professional, comprehensive, horrific documentation of what's been going on since it's almost been 100 days now. And I know that your audience, because you've been educating them, and I'm sure they're also looking into this more, has gone through the 84 pages of evidence that was then brought forward in the oral proceedings yesterday. So a momentous moment. Honestly, whatever the results are, the fact that the Palestinians had their day in court through South Africa is momentous enough. That's not to say that our efforts stop. In fact, now our efforts have to be even amplified, and we can talk about that in more detail. But it's just such a moment where we are seeing the shifting of power dynamics, you know, where the majority, where the global South, where people of color, where oppressed peoples, where former oppressed peoples are coming and saying, enough. We cannot have a Western-funded war on children, a war on women. This is the first televised genocide. And the people of the world are saying, this is not what we stand for. We stand for humanity. And South Africa's actions were a testament to that global feeling of solidarity with the Palestinian people.
You spoke about, and I'm really glad you brought that up. A lot of people, truthfully, did not know of the Palestinian plight. They had never heard of it. Heck, let's be frank, some people didn't even know Palestine existed. They only heard of Israel. You took the British government to court, all right? And what we're seeing today, I have to say, reminds me of, and that's not to sort of over egg the pudding, as we say in the UK, but it's just to say the importance of legal action and how win can come in so many different shapes and sizes. When the flotilla, which most people don't know about, was attacked by Israel and people, activists, innocent people were killed, you represented them, or at least PLAF was used to represent them. Tell us about that, and tell us about the consequence, what happened with the judicial review of taking the British government to court. Because I think people will understand again better, knowing that Mary has done this, and therefore, what could be done? What could happen with the ICJ?
Absolutely. So I'll take you through the two cases that you refer to. But before I do that, I just like to draw attention to the fact that today, there's increased momentum to do these types of cases because people now understand that we need to do them. And I serve on the board of the European Legal Support Centre, which is a network of lawyers across Europe and the UK that are looking to do strategic action and also are looking to support the Palestinian Solidarity Movement that are facing increasing repression throughout Europe and beyond. So the difference between now and the time when we did our cases is that people understand and people are behind it. And like I said, I'm so happy that we've come to this moment, even though it's in the shadow of one of the most horrific times I think most of us have ever seen and should never have seen. But to your point about the two cases, so the first one was a case that we facilitated that was led by Al-Haq, which is a Palestinian human rights organization. Actually, it's the first human rights organization in the Arab world, and everyone should know about them. They're leading on the advocacy side. And what we did together was try the UK government for the arms trade with Israel. So you see nowadays coming out of the United States and various Western countries, a call for Israel to limit civilian casualties. But at the same time, they are funding the bombs and the drones and all the military artillery that is being used to kill Palestinian children and women and men. And so we need to say, you know, your actions need to match your words. So the beauty of that case was, even though we didn't win the case, because it's difficult, we have to know that the sphere of politics and law often overlap, and we see this very much within the ICC domain at the moment. Even though we didn't win the war, it forced the UK government to review the arms licenses that it gives to Israel. And actually, recently, another case has been brought with a similar purpose. The other case is a very interesting one that we facilitated with UK lawyers and Spanish lawyers, which was in the aftermath of the attack of the Freedom Flotilla that was led by the Turkish Mavi Marmara group. So this was an example of peaceful activists that were looking to break the siege on Gaza. As you said multiple times in your previous shows, Gaza has been under a brutal siege, and now we're seeing, Arethi, and we should go into this maybe in the next question. What we're seeing is a continuum. Genocide doesn't happen in a vacuum. This is a continuum of consistent Israeli policies since 1948 that has spanned all of historic Palestine, not just Gaza, okay? And there have been multiple peaceful attempts like BDS, which we'll talk about, which is, you know, they're trying to criminalize it, and other peaceful protests like marches in Gaza that were also attacked, like the Freedom Flotilla, where we have tried peacefully to bring the plight of the Palestinian people, the continuous injustice that the Palestinian people have faced, to bring attention to what's happening. And the Freedom Flotilla was attacked by the Israeli army, and people were killed, and we were representing the claimants in that case. Now, you're not seeing necessarily solidarity activists killed by the Israelis, because simply they're not allowed in, but they have been. And, you know, you can look up Rachel Corrie, you can look at Thomas Herndl. Several solidarity activists have been killed in the past, but now you're seeing solidarity activists being threatened in countries such as Germany and so on. You're seeing solidarity activists lose their job. You're seeing solidarity activists being accused of course, anti-Semitism, of being terrorists. There's this level of anti-Palestinian racism that's being leveled not only against Palestinians, but against anyone who represents, you know, the Palestinian cause. And there are people now that are working on a framework for anti-Palestinian racism where we're saying, look, if we are criticizing the Zionist entity, if we are criticizing the state of Israel, that doesn't mean that we are terrorist sympathizers. Exactly. It doesn't mean that we are anti-Semitic. And we can talk about that in more detail, but just showing that, you know, the solidarity movement is being attacked in different ways. But you know what's really incredible about this moment is, despite the increasing repression, in spite of the censorship that we're seeing on social media channels, voices are increasing and increasing and increasing. And after yesterday's profound intervention at the ICJ, it's going to give activists even more motivation to keep going and taking action in different forms.
I'm so glad you brought up anti-Semitism. Palestinians are Semitic people too. So when you hear that nonsensical, and we can only call it nonsensical, that very nonsensical allegation against those who are pro-Palestine, those who are pro-peace, those who are pro-human rights. In fact, Netanyahu even called yesterday's proceedings anti-Semitic. What are your thoughts? What comes to your mind? How ridiculous does that sound to you?
It absolutely sounds ridiculous. You know, I did my undergraduate degree in the late 90s at Columbia, and I was already very active, Columbia University in New York, and I was already very active within the justice solidarity movement, so many other justice movements as well, because I've always said the Palestinian cause is a microcosm of so much injustice, you know. So we have to stand for all people who are facing injustice. In any case, I took a course on anti-Semitism to really understand what it means. And so I read a lot of literature on what anti-Semitism looked like in the past. So I understand that it's real. And the Jewish people historically did go through a very, very hard time, pogroms and so on, when it comes to anti-Semitism. And this is something that's well documented. I think what's happened now is this, equating anti-Semitism with anti-Zionism is actually very destructive for the Jewish people. And you see within America, like Jewish Voices for Peace and so on, them saying, equating anti-Semitism with anti-Zionism is essentially detrimental for the Jewish people. And when you look at the people who are actually anti-Semitic, they're usually right-wing extremists in the US and Europe that actually want Israel to remain because they don't want to deal with the Jewish people. It's absolutely ridiculous. So I think we can only look at the very brave and courageous voices like Jewish Voices for Peace that are saying, not in my name. This has nothing to do with anti-Semitism. This is to do with being against a Zionist terrorist regime that is one of the last colonial legacies of this planet, that is committing a genocide on the people of Gaza, where 1% of the population has already been killed. This has nothing to do with us disliking you because you are a Semite. You know, we are Semites, as you said, but I think it's mostly dangerous for the Jewish community. But thankfully, they are coming out to say, no, this is not, we do not stand for this.
You're also part very, very deeply involved in the BDS movement. And you've said the point of BDS is to isolate Israel at every level on the international and to ensure they comply with international law. We've had Omar Bugatti here before, but you know, one learns and you keep learning, and that's how we all learn. So I'd like you to talk to us again about BDS, what it means, how we can get involved, but most importantly, how it can ensure and push, force Israel to comply with international law.
Right, exactly. And I saw your interview with Omar Barghouti, and I think it was an excellent one. And I encourage everyone to watch that interview. But just to go back to basics for those who may have missed it, BDS stands for Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions. It's a global grassroots movement that is acting in response to a call from Palestinian civil society to take action, to essentially isolate Israel. And a lot of the BDS movement was inspired by the South African anti-apartheid movement that we've discussed before. So if you take each pillar of BDS one by one, actually, let me do this. Let me explain to you how I practice BDS, because I think it may be interesting to personalize it for people. So how do I practice boycott? So boycott for me means I will never buy a product that is made in Israel or by a company that is aiding and abetting Israel in any way. I'll take it a step further as a company owner. So our major family business is a hotel. We also, as a hotel, will not buy any Israeli products. So boycott is really up to the consumer to discern whether or not they will buy a particular product. And the beauty of the current moment is that there are so many websites where you can check whether a product is Israeli or part of a company that is supporting the Israeli apartheid occupation system. So that's really important. Divestment means what it says, is disinvesting or not investing in any company, again, that is aiding and abetting Israeli war crimes or Israel in any way. So for me, as someone who is an investor, I will look at every company that I invest in and ensure that they have no relationship to Israel. That the same goes for funds, for people who invest in any sort of fund. You need to look at the underlying holdings to make sure that no company there is also, aiding and abetting. And sanctions is probably the most important thing for me right now, as we're at this pivotal moment. It's calling for complete sanctions, especially military sanctions on Israel. So the point of the three pillars of BDS ultimately is to isolate Israel, to force it to comply with international law. There's often the example of you can't have negotiations between the prisoner and the prison guard. So what we're trying to do is level the playing field. And it's clear that Israel will not listen to anyone. And the whole international community has been completely impotent when it comes to pushing Israel to abide with international law. So BDS is a peaceful way of shifting that power dynamic, because at the end of the day, it's about shifting the power dynamic. There are efforts to try and criminalize BDS, and you can see the Israeli government over, I don't know how many years, has put so much money towards fighting the BDS movement, which shows, in fact, how effective it is. But you saw with apartheid South Africa that, you know, sports associations stopped associating with South Africa. So that means, for example, in our case, if there's an Israeli sports team, we will not be part of that sports game. Or let's say there are, you know, let's say I'm involved in film in Jordan. There's Israeli filmmakers that want to come and shoot their film in Jordan. It wouldn't be allowed. I wouldn't participate in that. So it's isolating them on the cultural scene, on the sports scene, you know, in any way possible. I've served on boards, for example. I serve on several boards at the moment where I have resigned because there has been some Israeli involvement. So unless that Israeli person or entity has explicitly spoken against the occupation or against apartheid, and they're explicitly working to redress the injustices that the Palestinian people have faced, they're a no-no. In old terms, before BDS was a thing, we were called the anti-normalization movement. So that means that we do not believe that you can have normal ties with a criminal regime in any way. So we live and breathe this. I think more and more people understand the power of this. And I think that's enough of a summary.
Okay, so we'll bring it back to today. Let me read something to you. Among the requested provisional measures is for Israel, this is, you know, this South Africa's demand that they wrote to the ICJ, is for Israel to cease its military operations in and against Gaza and abstain from engaging in genocidal acts, as delineated in Article 2 of the Geneva Genocide Convention. This encompasses stopping the killing and the inflicting of serious mental and bodily harm on the Palestinian people in Gaza, discontinuing the intentional imposition of conditions of life designed to result in their physical destruction as a group. Additionally, South Africa seeks measures asking Israel to prevent and punish direct and public incitement to genocide. Israel responded today. Let me give you some highlights. They mentioned Holocaust 4 times in the first sentence. They mentioned Hamas 66 times. They mentioned rape 6 times. They mentioned Hamas using human shields. And they mentioned anti-Semitism. And they said, we drop leaflets to teach, and they, Palestinians, teach hate to their kids. And it goes on and on and on and on. Israel tried to defend itself today. The first part, what are your thoughts on their presentation?
Okay. Before I go there, I just want people to look at the provisional measures that South Africa was requesting. And as I know your audience is already very well educated, for those of you who are reading the case on the 84-page submission, it's on page 82. And it lists all the provisional measures 1 through 9, which you already summarized beautifully. So let me just say, it's really, I mean, there's so much to say in there, but I just think when you compare the thoroughness of the South African case, when you consider the legal arguments submitted by the South African team versus what you heard today, I can just say the South African Act was a very hard act to follow. So, to answer your question, Israel had, I would say, 4 major defense arguments, right? Mm-hmm. The first one, of course, was self-defense. I think a lot of us we had already predicted what they were going to say. There was this beautiful bingo thing, I'm trying to find it, where we knew exactly what they were going to say. So we knew that they were going to say self-defense. I think, you know, for those of us who care about the law, we know that self-defense doesn't apply in this situation. So when they say self-defense, they're talking about Article 51 of the UN Charter. But self-defense, and this has been reiterated multiple times, including by the ICJ in the advisory opinion of 2004, and also recently by the Security Council, believe it or not, that Gaza is still occupied. So Israel doesn't have the right to self-defense because it's occupying the territory. So, of course, Israeli legal scholars, I shouldn't say scholars, Israeli legal
experts,
analysts, say, you know, Gaza is no longer occupied, but you can simply see that, I mean, in law we say effective control. In layman's terms, we can see that Israel can shut off the water, fuel, electricity, internet, can go in and bomb Gaza as they want. They control airspace, you know, the sea. I mean, it's obvious that Gaza is still under their occupation. So because of that and because of other reasons, they don't have the right to self-defense. And even if they did, nothing justifies genocide. I mean, even on this human shields argument, let's say, just for the sake of argument, if we were doing like a Hollywood film on the part of the Israelis and then we, you know, had all the tunnels under the hospital and so on, let's just say that that's fact. But we know that no evidence has been presented to that effect. Israel still doesn't have the right to bomb a hospital. Genocide is never acceptable in any shape or form. So anyway, that's their point on self-defense. Their second major line was that, you know, the South African team couldn't establish intent, the intent to commit genocide. And that's the most important part if you look at the definition of genocide, which you've gone through many times. I don't need to go through it. But they're saying that there's no intent because it's not government policy. Ireti, they said because it's not government policy. Okay, I will take your listeners through the South African 84-page documents, mm-hmm, starting on page 59, all right? From page 59 onwards, for about, I don't know how many pages, maybe 6 pages, the South African team lays out several statements of intent, okay? Starting from the Prime Minister of Israel, the President of Israel, the Israeli Minister of Defense, the Israeli Minister for National Security, the Israeli Minister of Energy and Infrastructure, okay? These are all people that have expressed in no uncertain terms, the Israeli intent to commit genocide. I'm going to continue. The Israeli Minister of Finance, the Israeli Minister of Heritage, which they said, you know, they had taken back the statement. Israeli Minister of Agriculture, Deputy Speaker of the Knesset and member of the Foreign Affairs and Security Committee. Israeli Army Coordinator of Government Activities in the Territory, COGAT, which they talked about a lot. Israeli Army Reservist, Major General, former head of Israeli National Security Council and advisor to the Defense Minister. So if those people do not represent Israeli government policy, please tell me who does. And beyond the statements, isn't the actions that Israel is committing on a daily basis clear-cut enough to show genocide? Let me show you. Today, okay, January 12th, while the court was in session, the Israeli Zionist army committed 13 massacres against families. Okay, today, while the court is in session, let me tell you another statistic which blows my mind. 80% of the world's population who are facing famine are in Gaza. Israel has killed 1% of the entire population. Israel has displaced almost 2 million Palestinians. That's 85% of the entire population. There have been over 30,000 people killed. Anyway, I have a lot of statistics. People can see them online. But the point is, if you take the statements of intent plus the actions that we are seeing being live streamed on Instagram, does that not show intent? When you have Israeli soldiers in Gaza who have already taken over houses and buildings and then they blow them up, what does that say? What is this? They are telepathizing themselves on TikTok, committing genocide. So that's the second point, all right? The third point in their main defense arguments is that Israel has a national court system. So they are a rules-based country with a legal system. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you heard that argument. Anyone who has been active in this space for decades will know that the Israeli court system is complicit in the ongoing occupation and apartheid system facing the Palestinian people. Even the judge, their ad hoc judge, Barak, who they brought to the ICJ, has been complicit in twisting international law as they see fit when it comes to Jerusalem, when it comes to home demolitions, when it comes to so many different things. So you cannot tell me that because the Israelis have a national court system, that they can handle their own accountability. The last two points that are significant in the case, and I'll stop after I go through this, is the issue of jurisdiction. And I think a lot of people are a bit worried about this issue because it sounded compelling, okay? And this was one of the procedural points that was brought up. So just for your listeners, in case they haven't gone through this, in order for the ICJ to have jurisdiction under the Genocide Convention, there has to be a dispute. Mm-hmm. Okay, this is the main point. So Israel was saying in its arguments today that there's no dispute. Okay. If you look yesterday at John Dugard's part, mm-hmm. amazing person, amazing lawyer, he goes through every single reason why you can consider what's going on now a dispute. Okay. Also, for those of you who have read the South Africa submission, point 15 and 16 also refer to the fact that there's a dispute. I'm not too worried about that because actually in precedent, there's only been two cases that have been thrown out at this stage on based on the dispute point. And also the definition that the ICJ uses for disputes is quite broad. Basically, what states need to show is that there were some efforts, diplomatic letters and so on that took place before the case was lodged at the ICJ. And South Africa did plenty and John Dugard went through it point by point. So I'm not too worried about it, but it's something that came up that people should be aware of. I think the only interesting point for me as a lawyer, was the fourth lawyer. So for those of you who were watching, the first lawyer was Barrister Malcolm Shaw.
Yeah.
I'm a barrister too. I'm a non-practicing barrister. I don't think I'm going to call myself a barrister now after watching his statement. I mean, honestly, it was very disappointing. I'm sure he's going to be internally embarrassed for, his performance. I mean, he couldn't even speak. He was like choking. His papers were all over the place. I think it was his conscience. His conscience was coming up and like strangling his throat chakra. So we have Malcolm Shaw, who was the first one. And then we had Galit Dragwan, who's the acting director of the International Justice Division at Israel's Justice Ministry. I don't know why I have balloons that just came up there. Okay. And then the third lawyer was an Israeli lawyer, Omri Sender. And then the fourth lawyer, and this is the one that I think was interesting, is Christopher Staker. So he is an international lawyer who was on the tribunal for the former Yugoslavia. And he went in detail against the provisional measures that we were talking about before, the nine that I mentioned before that South Africa has asked for. Mainly, we're calling for a ceasefire, cease and desist, injunction, stop the killing, right? And he went through why he does not believe these provisional measures should be issued. And I think his main point was that they are unwarranted and would prejudice Israeli rights. And the other point that was made in conclusion by Israel's Deputy Attorney General Gilad Noam is that the standard for provisional measures, which are irreparable harm and urgency, are not met because Israel has taken steps to address the humanitarian crisis. Okay, so we can go through the nonsense of that. But I think the only two legal procedural points that I think people should pay attention to is this dispute issue. I think we need to look into that a bit. And the comments that Christopher Staker, the fourth lawyer, made on the provisional measures. But other than that, to hear, you know, the Raghwan, Galit Raghwan, talk about how hospitals haven't been targeted, and to hear about how they are, you know, dropping leaflets so people can leave and opening safe places, you know, for people to go. Your listeners already know this. The people of the world already know there is no safe place to go in Gaza. When they have told people to go, they have bombed them. We saw 2-3 days ago a grandmother holding her grandson with a white flag, and they are targeted. Do you know more journalists have been killed in Gaza than all of World War II?
Yeah.
So don't tell me you're mitigating civilian harm. They actually said, and this was one point that made me laugh out loud, they have a unit that's responsible for mitigating civilian harm. So I suggest to whatever Israeli government official that's watching now, perhaps you need to check, you know, the efficacy of that unit, because the claims that Israel is trying to mitigate civilian harm, when in fact it is entirely clear that they are trying to destroy the Palestinian people in Gaza, and this is part of their policy for the past 75 years, is clear to anyone who has two eyes and a brain.
Thank you. ICC, ICJ, most people don't know the difference. Please tell us, what is the difference between both? In fact, incidentally, I heard a Nigerian journalist this morning on our TV here. He actually said, and he's a lawyer, he said, oh, I would have preferred if South Africa had gone to the ICC, because the ICC actually focus on individuals and the ICJ focuses on countries. I don't know how far that is true. Please talk us through the difference between both.
I mean, it's so compelling that that discussion is happening. I would tell this journalist that, in fact, South Africa has already gone to the ICC. They went several months ago, and, you know, that's also an incredible step. So the differences are very, very simple. I think people get confused because they just sound the same. But basically, yeah. The ICJ is the UN legal arm, and it's been set up to address disputes among states, whereas the ICC was set up by the Rome Statute, and it's to address, you know, war crimes and other crimes under the Rome Statute addressed by individuals. I mean, those two international courts are important to a degree, but I think those of us who've been watching the ICC ever since Palestine basically signed up to the Rome Statute, basically the ICC hasn't done anything. And I think the consensus is that it's a highly political court. We've had several special prosecutors over the past couple of years. The current one, again, another barrister, Karim Khan, has visited the state of Israel recently. He's met with the families of hostages, even though Israel is not a signatory to the Rome Statute. You know, Palestinians and other groups have been trying to get the ICC to investigate obvious crimes, and they haven't taken any steps. So I think that despite there are some good lawyers like Gilles Devers, who has been leading what he called the legal army at the ICC, I think that we shouldn't place too much hope on the ICC. That doesn't mean we shouldn't continue, but I don't think that's where the Palestinians are going to see any form of justice. At the ICJ, obviously, we have this current provisional measures order that's going to be deliberated over the next couple of weeks. And it should be known by the audience that after this provisional measures order stage, which may lead to a cease and desist order, it may not. And as my comrade Noura Arakat has said many times, the people have judged this as genocide. So we don't need, 15 judges that could be somewhat political to tell us that. I mean, it's obvious. And it's not clear, how politicized the judges are at the ICJ. There are 15 from different countries. We can go through them. And we need a majority vote for the provisional measures orders to pass. But, we also have a new set of judges that are coming in the beginning of February. So 5 new judges will come to the ICJ. But there's another important case at the ICJ, which is an advisory opinion that was requested by the General Assembly, which is important for people to follow, okay, which is calling for an analysis on the status of the occupation, because Israel has occupied, Palestinian territories for years and, of course, says it that it doesn't. But, we are very hopeful that the ICJ will issue an advisory opinion on the occupation that will really elucidate the situation there. And there was an ICJ opinion of 2004 on the illegality of the apartheid wall in the occupied West Bank that people should be aware of. In addition to those two major courts, Eretzi, people should be aware that there are domestic courts all over the world where people can be bringing legal action. So, there's a concept called universal jurisdiction, mm-hmm, that people can use to varying degrees in different jurisdictions. There's also corporate complicity. I mean, there's so many different things that we can do in domestic courts. So I think it's a matter of looking at these international courts, also looking at domestic courts, and doing the best that we can on all sides.
Thank you. The calls, the lines are going, and I hadn't even announced the number, 0700-993-993-993. The female-only line is 01465-7190. But you should have been sending WhatsApp, because I told you guys, WhatsApp works. She's my guest first before she becomes your own. You know that. You know how we do it here. 0809-597-5805. We are on the web, nigeriainfo.fm. Twitter is nigeriainfo.fm. YouTube is nigeriainfo993. Facebook is nigeriainfo993. Instagram is nigeriainfo.fm Lagos. I will be coming to your calls in a moment. Zainab, do we have any questions or any, questions preferably?
Yeah, sure, we do.
On WhatsApp. Can you read some out, please?
Yes, so Henry from Shagamu says, please help me ask your guest, why did Hamas attack Israel, raped and slaughtered their citizens in cold blood?
That was asked in court. Right, keep going. Can we get another question?
Okay, Sisi Oge, good evening, Sisi Oge. This is Mark from Lekki. Why is it that back in 2022, South African lawyers and legal scholar Tembeka argued that South African politicians singing "Kill the Boer" is not a genocidal rhetoric? In 2023, that same lawyer is proving Israel's genocidal intent in Gaza before the International Court of Justice. Is that not playing double standard?
I'm not aware of the case you're talking about, so I can't make a comment.
Okay.
There's another one that I saw with regards to religion.
Yes. Sisi Oge, I think we are too over-religious and sentimental in Nigeria. How can Israel continue this genocide and WHO, EU, and America didn't sanction them? I believe Russia haven't come close to this before. Russia and Russians have been sanctioned over the globe. Engineer Kenny from Ireland.
Okay, thank you.
Ibrahim, I have to tell you, I couldn't hear the questions because your mouth is too close to the mic.
Right, right.
So you're going to have to repeat them. But can I just say one thing that I forgot to say about the ICJ work? Because it's really important, I think, for your listeners to hear this point, which is now, as I mentioned, we're at the provisional measures stage where, they'll come up with whatever they decide. But then we go into the merit stage, Eretzi, and the merit stage is where other states can lodge formal interventions to support the South African case, or they can even join the case. So this is the moment where, the people of the world that are standing up for humanity can lobby their governments to intervene formally. You know, recently there have been statements by Turkey, Jordan, the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, Malaysia, Bolivia, Venezuela, the Maldives, Namibia, Pakistan, and many other countries that have made statements in support of the South African case at the ICJ. But now what we need to see is countries officially intervening, you know, with legal opinions or joining the South African case. So I just think that's really important.
Thank you.
Could you just repeat very quickly the question?
Well, some of the questions have been answered before, but the one I do want to go to is people often default to religion. So there's clearly, well, somebody's obviously presuming that you're Muslim or whatever. Talk All to right. us, yes, about, you know, the wrong notion, and I have to say that because we've said it on this show many, many times, that this is a religious war, and because in Nigeria, it is a very religious society, and you, Mary, you're Christian.
Yes, no, absolutely. I think this is another way to deflect from the fact that this is a justice struggle. You know, this is a struggle for rights. This is not in any way a religious struggle. And, you know, we've seen how many churches in Gaza have been bombed. There have been 3 churches targeted and destroyed in Gaza over this past genocide. I have a friend who had family in the church, and she was just waiting to hear about what happened to them, the church that was bombed. There is a significant Palestinian Christian minority amongst the Palestinian people. I mean, my parents are Catholic, you know, and there's several of us. So you cannot essentialize and say, you know, this is a Muslim issue. It's not. I mean, for those of you that are looking for inspiration, just listen to the Christmas Eve sermon that came out of Bethlehem. And this is the birthplace, you know, of Christ. And they're Palestinian Christians that are facing extreme repression, like all Palestinians throughout occupied Palestine. So this is not a religious issue. This is an issue of fundamental rights. This is an issue of the last colonial regime that is existing. Nigeria had its post-colonial moment, and so have most other countries.
That's
all
right.
Palestinians are asking for is their fundamental freedoms.
Yeah.
All Palestinians want in Gaza is the right to determine their future. Okay, now they're asking for water. They're asking for not to be killed. They're asking for the right to life. But essentially, the Palestinian cause is about freedom. It's about justice. It's about redress. It's about restitution. It's about the return of the largest and longest standing refugee population on this planet. In Jordan alone, there are 9 refugee camps where Palestinians have been living since 1948 or 1967. In Lebanon, you have Palestinian refugees that are living in abysmal conditions. This is not something that started on October 7th. This is something that started in 1948 with the Palestinian Nakba. And today we see a Nakba, a catastrophe that's even bigger than the one that we saw in 1948. When you say that this is about anti-Semitism, or if you say this is about a religious war, you are deflecting the realities that I am describing.
Thank you so much, Marie. Let me answer a couple of calls when I come back. I do want you to tell us though what we should expect after yesterday and today. So I will be asking you that before, you know, our listeners can get very possessive. So if I don't answer one or two of their calls, I shall get in trouble. Bear with me. Hello.
Hello.
Yes, good afternoon. What's your name and where you calling from? What? Questions only, please.
My name is Samson. I'm calling from the village.
Okay, go ahead, Samson. Question, please, very quickly.
Okay, my question is this. I want to ask your guest a question that we should all understand. When I heard all the things she said, but let's consider this. Who started the war?
What is your question?
My question is, why did Hamas started the war and the government of Palestine did not do anything to intervene in stopping them from invading Israel?
Okay, thank you.
Why?
Bear with me, Mary. Hello?
I think I heard the question.
Hold on a second. Let me just take one more. Hello? Yes, good afternoon.
Yeah.
Good evening, sister.
Good evening, good evening. What's your name and where
you're
calling from?
Okay, you have something online.
Right, very good question. Quickly.
Yes, my question is about South Africa.
Okay.
Please, what concerns South Africa in all of this?
Okay, thank you.
What is there? What is Ramaphosa's issue?
Okay, thank you. Thank you. I think it's clear. You want to know what South Africa's business
is? What is his problem?
Oh, his problem? Okay, all right. Okay, Mary, you heard that. So the first question is, clearly, I think what he's trying to say is, why does South Africa care about this? But he says, you know, what's South Africa's business in all of this, that they actually took the steps, the legal steps that they took? The other question was, and we've had this a long 100 times, we've had it answered in so many different ways. Clearly, somebody thinks you should answer it again, is why did Hamas attack Israel? You've got 5 minutes to answer that because you've got to tell us what to expect. So I'm going to give you 5 minutes to answer those two questions.
I'll do all three. What to expect, the Hamas thing. And,
excellent. Okay, go ahead.
South Africa. Okay. I mean, your listener, look, I appreciate all the questions. People are coming to this with different levels of knowledge, you know. And, you know, people think that this started on October 7th because this is precisely how the U.S. and Israel is presenting it. And you can also see in today's proceedings at the ICJ, I mean, it's all about October 7th. I mean, what I would tell your listener is this did not start on October 7th. I've said it multiple times now. This is something that's been a continuum that started from 1948. You've seen it across historic Palestine from, you know, the mistreatment of Palestinians that are living in historic Palestine. You see Israeli policies towards Jerusalem, towards the West Bank, towards prisoners, towards Gaza. I mean, it's ongoing. And, you know, I would just invite listeners who think that this started on October 7th just to watch different news. You know, listen to anti-Zionist Israelis who talk about this. I mean, you've interviewed Gideon Levy. And he did an excellent job. You know, just read a little bit deeper than, you know, what the U.S. media is telling you. Watch Jazeera International. It's an excellent station that really gives you context, you know, on what's happening. This did not start on October 7th. This has been going on for 75 years. So that's answering the first point. The second point is the Genocide Convention gives a duty to all states to step up to the plate when it comes to the prevention of genocide. Any country, in fact, could have invoked the Genocide Convention. There's a lot of reasons why some Arab countries didn't, but I think that, you know, South Africa is realizing that actually what's at stake now is the sanctity of international law itself. Because it's such an open and shut case. If the ICJ does not see the merits of this case, really, we have a much bigger problem, or maybe an opportunity to finally create institutions that represent the majority of the people, that are built by the global South, that represent people of color and people who have faced a colonial history. Like, we have a moment to rethink these institutions. I mean, what international order has been unable to stop a genocide for 100 days? Isn't it time for new organizations and for people to really take power? So anyway, to answer her question, any state, including South Africa, has the duty to prevent genocide, and they have standing at the ICJ because they're a signatory. But really, any state could have done it. And like I said before, you know, other states should be encouraged to either intervene or join the South African case. So to your question, which is the...
What do we expect? Yes, what should we expect? What are the possibilities? Because I do have to confess, I am nervous, like a lot of people are. And we, you know, the UN has lost a great deal of respect in the eyes of the public because it's been clear that they're able, you know, the US is able to bully. Like people say, what's the point of the UN if the US can veto a sensible vote, a sensible resolution like ceasefire, you know, stop killing. That's literally what it means. Put your gun aside. What should we expect from the ICJ? What could they possibly say that would make us happy? What could they possibly rule that would actually depress us further? That's the honest truth.
Yeah, right. Well, first of all, I don't think our happiness needs to rely on the ICJ. We need to be happy when we continue protesting, when we continue working together, when we continue to see there's so many intersectionalities between our experience and your experience. It's the power of our, global solidarity movement that will bring us happiness.
Right.
But if we're looking for, something to come out of the ICJ, look, there are different opinions on this. If you look at Norman Finkelstein, who, we all respect, he's quite, cynical on, how the judges will vote. Other people that I know who have sort of more insider information off the court say, no, these are independent judges. And hopefully they will vote on the merits. And we have a Ugandan judge, by the way, for those of you who are listening. So I'd be curious to see, where they stand. In any case, I think probably the reality is somewhere in between. We have the chair lady of the court, Donoghue, who's actually leaving her post, in a couple of weeks. So,
right.
We'll see what will happen. I think we will probably get an order which is okay.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think necessarily it's going to be everything that we would want. Mm-hmm. But let's say, just for the sake of optimism, that the provisional measures order is exactly, what we're looking for. The issue, of course, is that this is a binding determination of the law.
Mm.
According to a case called Legras in 2001, it reiterated that any measures given by the ICJ are, I'm not advisory opinions, I'm talking about this type of ruling, is binding.
Right.
However, as we know, compliance is a different issue.
Mm.
And the ICJ obviously doesn't have powers to make any state comply with their ruling. So let's say that South Africa gets a cease and desist order. So they get an injunction. Israel is, called to stop killing Palestinians in Gaza. The first thing that is important is the world will know.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, this is a declaration.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
No one can say they didn't know. Okay, that leads to a duty to prevent. This is an active duty that people need to act to. So that means stop arming Israel and so on. The issue of enforcement ultimately will go to the Security Council, because the Security Council, the UN, the ICJ is the legal arm of the United Nations. So at that point, the United States is going to be in a position where it will be embarrassed, because you have a declaration, the highest courts on this planet is saying, Stop killing.
Yeah.
Can I say I'm hopeful that at that moment the United States will not veto? Probably not. But I can say that there's a lot of work that needs to be done in the United States.
Mm.
And people are doing the work. There's a lot of domestic law cases that have come up. People are doing direct action. They're blocking roads. Jewish Voice of Peace are doing amazing. But there is amazing work that's being done. How long that takes to resonate, in the halls of power, I think it's, yet to be determined. But in any case, let's say that the U.S. does veto, which is the most likely scenario. The General Assembly then has a moment where they can invoke the United for Peace resolution. And if you are in